It was a good crew. There was one member, however, that had a slight speech impediment. He stuttered. And when he got upset or nervous, he couldn't talk at all. But they took off and they got out over the Atlantic some 2-3 hours, and everything was real quiet and everything was going along real smoothly. Some of the fellows were eating, some were reading, some listening to the radio, and all of a sudden the intercom popped and cracked, and this very excited voice said, "Navigator to the pilots, right engine's on fire." And the captain, in a very calm voice, replied, "That's all right. We'll just feather that prop and blow that fire out, and we'll go on one engine. We're all right." He says, "Okay." Some 2 or 3 hours later, they had gotten out past the point of no return. Most of the crew were asleep, even the pilot. He had the ship set on automatic pilot, and he was taking a nap. And all of a sudden, the intercom really popped. And this same voice said, "Navigator to the pilot, to the damn nerve engine's on fire now." Once again, the captain very calmly replied, "Well, that does it. That's all she wrote. We just have to hit the silk. We have no choice." The voice says, "Hell, I can't do it. Don't know how." He said, "Well, it's simple, really. He says, let the rest of the crew go, and you get your shoot on and wait for me at the back door." He said, "Okay. A few minutes later, the captain and the navigator were standing at the back door, and the captain says, "You just catch hold of this little ring, and you fall head first and count to 10. Then you pull this, and you float down just as gently as a feather." He says, "Okay, Captain Bendall." They were up about 5,000 feet, and the captain got down about 50 feet from the water, and something went by him like a bat out of hell. When he went by, the captain heard him say, "Six." This pretty well describes how I feel. For when I realize where I am standing on a Sunday morning, in a spot where have stood the kind of people that I know deep down inside of me that I will never be able to quite measure up to, standing here recalling where I came from, I realize the full significance of the words, "My God, how great thou art." Because from where I started to this spot, well, there just ain't no way you can get here from there but through the grace of God. And I don't want to talk about drinking this morning, because this program is really not about drinking. And I don't want to talk too much about not drinking, because the program's not about not drinking either. I want to talk about something that up until a few short years ago I knew absolutely nothing about. Living. That's what this program is about. It's a living program for a living problem. I've been asked to tell one or two things, and I don't quite know how to put all this together, but bear with me. Like Francis, I don't think I was ever a sociable drinker. I wasn't sociable sober. I was, even as a child, I was a mean little boy. I've heard people say that they enjoyed a few years of sociable drinking and then became an alcoholic. I've heard others say they were born an alcoholic. I don't guess I'll ever know which category I fit into. I did have one psychiatrist to tell me once that I was born about a half a pint below normal. And I've never argued with that, because I know in the very beginning it took about this much to make me feel that I was somewhere near the point of normalcy. Oh, I felt at ease among other people. You see, if there is such a thing as a reason for a person becoming addicted to alcohol, mine was an inferiority complex. Due, I have been told, and I believe this too, these scars on my face. You see, I was burned in a house fire when I was 18 months old. And up until I was about 22, when I was in Walter Reed Hospital with a leg crushed, where I spent a little over 3 years, up until then, three-fourths of my face was covered with scars. I couldn't close my mouth, I couldn't close my eyes, and I had no ears. These two are grafted. I won one of them in a blackjack game. Another one belonged to a little Irish boy from Brooklyn that couldn't hear out of it anyway. But this was a big stumbling block in my life, because as a child in school, I had all of the nicknames tacked to me, such as Scarface, and some much worse than that. So when the psychiatrist said that 2-3 drinks made me feel like I was the other fellow's equal, I didn't argue, because I think maybe there was some semblance of truth in this. I know that a drink of white liquor always did make me feel that I was somebody. Not ugly, maybe even handsome or pretty. But this boy was way off when he said 2-3 drinks made me feel I was anybody's equal. Because 2 drinks of white liquor always did put me so far ahead and so high above everybody else that they looked pitiful to me. And after 3 drinks, I just took over. If I was at a party, it became my party. And I told everybody just what to do and how to do it. If I was at a dance, it became my dance. And everybody danced the way I wanted to dance. The orchestra played just what I wanted to hear. If it didn't mean the orchestra leader stepped outside, or maybe I'd take a poke at him right down the floor. From the very beginning, at 13 years old, I was this kind of a drunk, an ornery, mean, troublemaking drunk. So you can understand why in a very small town of less than 200 people, why this kind of drinking in a very short while made me a very lonesome boy. I wasn't invited to parties, and I couldn't buy my way into a dance if I'd ever been there before. It got to where I won't even welcome in church, because all the preachers around home soon woke up to the fact that any time they saw me sitting in the congregation, they knew they could expect me to come around when the service was over and tell them how much I had enjoyed the sermon, how much it had meant to me. How it had showed me all my troubles and problems and just what to do about it. How if he just let me have about $2 till I could get on my feet, I was going to be one of his strongest church workers. I ain't never seen a preacher I couldn't get $2 out of until some of these drunks went into the ministry. My father, bless his heart, put up with 3 years of this. But he finally reached a point that he couldn't take it anymore. My father has never known the meaning of failure. He has always been successful in everything he tried. He saw in me a part of himself that failed. And 3 years of this was all he could stand. So in 1936, when I was just 16 years old, he told me one day that he didn't know what was wrong with me or what I was going to do about it, but it had to be done somewhere else. That he wanted me to go and just stay gone. I say now, without any feeling of shame, that for many, many years, even after I got sober in AA, I actually hated this old gentleman. I didn't go too far from home, 60 miles to the city of Lynchburg, because I felt sure that it would just be a short while when this old fellow would realize that he'd made a big mistake and that he needed me. 30-some years went by. And all during this time, I didn't have a father. My father didn't have a son. He meant what he said. He wanted me to stay gone. I spent a little more than 4 years in Lynchburg. not working or even pretending to work, but as a bum, more of an animal than a human being. I got to know a lot of people in high places in Lynchburg. A judge and I got on a first name basis. I knew all of the policemen. And then September 16th, 1940. You see, down in Lynchburg, they had a standard sentence for a drunk. We called it a jelly roll. It was a 5.5 fine, 11 days on the city farm. And when I went before Judge McCain on September 16th, 1940, for the 85th time, I noticed when I walked in the courtroom that morning that something new had been added. For along one wall, they had set up several tables, and behind each one there was a recruiting officer from some branch of service. That morning, Judge McCain, instead of giving me the customary jelly roll, offered me instead a choice of either a hitch in some branch of service or a year and a day on the state road. Well, that afternoon, I became a soldier. Not because of patriotism or anything as foolishly sentimental as that, but simply because I thought that the Army had more to offer a man of my ability than the highway department. The Army didn't stop me from drinking. It changed my pattern a little. Where before, I'd been able to devote 24 hours a day, if necessary, to drinking or hustling something to drink. And the Army had expected me to work about 4 hours. Other than that, I didn't find it too different from civilian life. They called the jail by a different name. It was a brig or stockade, and I was spending the customary time in it. Late in 1941, in August, when I had been through 7 court-martials, I wasn't too far from getting one of these blue slips. That's the type of discharge they give an alcoholic. It's not exactly a dishonorable discharge, but it ain't the kind your wife frames and hangs in the middle. And I know that I was right on the verge of being awarded one of these, and it was during the Louisiana maneuvers, and I was doing convoy duty, riding a motorcycle. One morning, about daybreak, just outside of Richmond, Virginia, me and a motorcycle and a guardrail post tangled. And I wound up in Walter Reed Hospital up in Washington with a leg crushed pretty badly. The first few weeks I was there, I was pretty sick because it looked like I was going to lose my leg. And for some reason, laying there, I sort of began to take stock of myself, to look back on the past 6 years. And what I saw in looking back wasn't very pretty. For 6 years before, I had walked out or been put out of a good home, a Christian home. And I very seldom say this anymore. I've heard so many people in AA get up and say, I was raised in a Christian home. It makes you wonder sometimes, maybe this ain't the wrong kind of place to try to raise children. But I had taken a much better than average opportunity of making something out of myself, and had swapped it all for a bottle of wine and set out on my own that spring morning, fully confident that I could do just as well, perhaps even better than anybody in my family had ever done. But now, 6 years later, what did I have to show for my efforts? A home? The Army was all the home I had. And I knew that if I lost my leg, I'd be discharged, and I figured a service record with 7 court martials on it would keep me from being accepted in a veteran's home. Money, I had $50 coming next payday. And what had I made of myself? A one-legged drunken bum. I felt pretty sorry for myself. But what could I do about it? I couldn't think of but one thing. Down Ward 11, every night about 8:30 or 8:45, the little nurses came down through the ward, getting everybody fixed up for the night. Some of the fellows got a shot. Some of them got a capsule or a pill. Some of them just got a back rub and a smile. But that night, Private Haygood in bed 13 got nearly a full quart of rubbing alcohol that somehow got misplaced while the nurse was fixing bed 14. Next morning, about 3 o'clock, they rolled me into a private room, blind, stinking, drunk, and raising holy hell. As I say, I was a patient at Walter Reed for 3 years and 27 days, and except for that first month, I think you could say it was just one long drunk, because liquor wasn't too hard to get. Wine was a little easier because it's cheaper. And that rub-a-dub was everywhere. You could buy a 4-ounce bottle from most any ward boy for 15 cents. And it was here at Walter Reed that I had my first case of DT. Somehow I had missed them up to now. But it was during one of these particularly long and hard sessions with this rub that one night in the middle of the night I run out. You remember what that was like. But I got out of my bunk and took a pillowcase and I went through everybody's wall locker and gathered up all the bottles I could find. Got back in my bunk and in the dark I picked out the biggest bottle I could find and I took a big dust cutter, 5 or 6 big swallows. But it turned out it wasn't Aqua Velva or Lucky Tiger or anything as palatable as that. It was Clenzo shampoo. I could blow all them bubbles out, but I couldn't get none of them back. This little Mexican kid in the bed next to me, he seen me foaming at the mouth. He figures I'm having some kind of a fit, so he calls a nurse, and they rushed me over to the emergency room, and I swallowed yards and yards of that hose. While they're pumping me out, I blew up. From there, they transferred me over to Ward 16. Or as we called it up there, I went over and joined the yo-yo squad. And after a few days, when they got me so I could stay on the ground, they turned me over to an old colonel who at that time was said to have been one of the most successful psychiatrists in the country in dealing with our kind of people. He got me in his office and he took a little rubber hammer and he tapped all of my joints. Took a pair of calipers and measured my skull. Asked me about a million questions, the kind I wouldn't ask a dog. And all the time he's doing this, he's writing. In 3 weeks, he wrote a book on me about the size of Gone with the Wind. And that's exactly what I thought it was, too. Finally, when he had me just about nuts, he told me one morning, he says, "Haygood, that does it." So I finished my examination. He showed me his notes stacked about that high. And he said, "The answer to all your problems are in these notes." Hell, my whole family history was in there. And he says, "I'm going to have to study these for a little while. And in the meantime, I want you to go back to your room and try not to worry too much because we might be able to do something for you." But all this had scared the hell out of me. I never had these things before and had all these little people climbing out from in my pajama jacket and the pillowcase. I mean, people I knew. A whole lot of them was dead. So I went back to my room or to my cell, but I didn't take it easy. I walked the floor night and days, except when they'd give me a shot or something to knock me out. And my stomach hurt. I figured that's ruptured ulcers. Him measuring my head with them calipers, I figured it's cancer of the brain or at least a small tumor. So I even began wondering what my funeral was going to be like. There I was, over 200 miles from home, and I could think of a lot of people back home that would enjoy very much seeing me put away, but I couldn't picture none of them driving 200 miles for it. I didn't know nobody in Washington except the other fellows on Ward 11. They were all bed patients. They couldn't come. That left me and the chaplain and the bugler and the Paul Bowers and the firing squad. And I was the only one in the bunch, even you. So I just won't get no better. One morning, the little nurse comes to the peephole in the door, and she says, "The colonel wants to see you." And I walked in his office, and he didn't help things none. He says, "Sit down, son, and get a grip on yourself. I got some bad news for you." He says, "Before I tell you what I've discovered, I'd like to talk to you a few minutes about alcohol." That was all right. Right about then, a pint of rub would have been about two good drinks. He says, "Whiskey can kill a man three ways. Say it can ruin his stomach." My ulcer started burning. Say it can ruin his liver, just make it harden until it stops working. Mine felt like a rock. He said, "It can affect a man's mind." He says, "Now don't let this throw you, boy, but your mind might not ever be normal again." It didn't throw me. Hell, it didn't even faze me. My mind never had been normal. And then he said, "Much as I hate to tell you this, in studying your case history, I have discovered that you are an alcoholic." How about that? This old genius with his hammers and his calipers and his questions, he done worried the hell out of me for 3 weeks. And then left me for 2 more weeks, walked the floor, wondering if they're going to bury me next Sunday evening or early Monday morning, while he's a-studying. And then after all this research, he comes up with this amazing discovery. Something I know before I got in high school. I think maybe it did go a little off there for a while, because it was several days before anybody could even get close to me for anything except to get hit or get cussed at. But Dad, Walter Reed, they had what we called the cocoon treatment. They had these long white sheets that they rolled and wrapped you in till you couldn't move nothing but your eyeballs. They had two big color balls, one on each end, and they had two big tubs of water, one just before freezing, the other one about 2 minutes past boiling, and they just dunked you in first one, then the other. It don't make no difference how mad you are, you get over it. And it went along till I ended up back in the colonel's office, and he was real nice to me, always was. This time they used a little different approach. He said that in his opinion, since I had been drinking so many different kinds of stuff for so long, and since alcohol seemed to play such a major part in my personality makeup, he thought it would be foolish or maybe even dangerous for me to try to quit. That instead I ought to learn how to drink, like a gentleman. I didn't know gentlemen drank. But he said he did, but not rubbing alcohol. And Solox and cleanso shampoo. He said gentlemen drank mixed drinks, and if they didn't drink them about a quart or a half a gallon, he said a gentleman at a party or a dance during the course of an evening would have one or two, certainly not more than three drinks. And I remember thinking gentlemen must have mighty weak stomachs. But after a week or so of this kind of hogwash, he told me one day that since I was responding to treatment so nicely and getting along so well, he thought it'd be safe for me to go back to my own ward. And that provided I could find some reliable person to go with me, he might even arrange for me to get an overnight pass to go over town. Well, down on Ward 16, there was a little nurse, pretty little thing. She's from Macon, Georgia. We called her Peachy. I'd been talking to her ever since I'd been over there, and, well, just judging from the way she talked, I figured she'd be mighty reliable for a pass. She had promised to go out with me if I ever got out. And sure enough, in a few days, I had me a pass and a date with Peachy and was raring to go. But that afternoon, when we went by the colonel's office to pick up the pass, he kind of upset my plans a little. He said, "Son, on this pass, you got 24 hours, but I want you to take just one drink." That sounded like a hell of a way to treat a fellow been locked up for 6 weeks, but we went on. We ended up in a real nice place there in Washington at Peachy Newburgh. Place with about 15, 20 tables and maybe twice that many people. After the waiter had gotten us seated, Peachy told him we'd have something to drink before we ate. And he brought us the whiskey menu, I reckon he called it, and I looked at mine. I couldn't pronounce half what was on it. So I called him over and I says, "Doc, what's the biggest drink you got?" Well, he looks down his nose at me like I ain't real clean, and he points to something down near the bottom of the page he said was mighty popular. It was Blue Blazer. $2. $2 sounded like a hell of a price to pay for one drink, but, well, the name of the thing kind of appealed to me. A Blue Blazer sounded like a right potent drink for a gentleman. So I ordered one, and Peachy ordered something, and in a few minutes he come back with a little thing about big as an egg cup, had an olive in it with a little ginger ale or something splashed over it. That's for Peachy. For me, he had a thing about big as a milkshake shaker. It had a good pint of liquor in it, and I thought, "Look out, Colonel, I'm going to be late getting home." But he set it down in front of me and then done what I thought was the damnest fool thing I ever seen a white man do. He struck a match to it and set the fire. I hadn't been used to nothing like that. Back home sometimes we'd accidentally spill a little white liquor on the table, on the floor, and we'd set the fire just for fun. But hell, the $2 a throw, I'm gonna play. I looked around and won't nobody else paying no attention to it, and Peachy sitting right there at it, won't bothering her none. But I was just an old country boy, I didn't know nothing. But I know they weren't gonna pay $2 for a drink, sit and watch it burn up. So I takes me a deep breath and pulls it down. Fine off. I still think it ought to be against the law to sell a man a thing like that. Without telling him what to do, or at least ask him if he knows what the hell he's doing. Peachy said my neck run out about a foot. Looked like a red streak. I turned red all over. And I upset the table right behind me trying to get out. And before I could get to the front door, two big waiters grabbed me, one under each arm, and on out through the kitchen to the back door and dumped me out in the alley. By the time I got myself together and got out to the sidewalk, the MPs had come, and they took me on over town and locked me up. That was the longest night I ever spent in anybody's jail. I drank water out of everything in there. Next morning, the old colonel come down and got me and took me back to Ward 16. That afternoon, we was all in his office, and Peachy was telling him about what happened. I couldn't speak above a whisper. I just give up all hopes of ever being a gentleman drinker. And I know that I just didn't have the stomach for it. Well, I reckon the old colonel must have been a little bit disgusted with me, because all along when they got me so I could eat a little soup and drink a little milk, he gave me my discharge one morning. He says, "Go on home, Higgins, and quit worrying." Says, "Drink your liquor and have your fun." Says, "You probably won't live long, but when you die, you won't know the difference." I was glad to get that discharge. And I went home, and I had been home once before on a furlough, and drunk, I had gotten married. A marriage that should never have been, really. But the war was still going on, everybody was still feeling patriotic, and it wasn't hard for a veteran to get a job, especially one on crutches. And I wound up with a pretty good one as telegraph operator for the Southern Railway. And on the strength of having a good job and using the GI Bill, I managed to borrow a few $1,000 to build a house. It's a cinder block house, supposed to be in a brick house, but I drank up the brick while it lay in the block. But everything was going along real nicely, I thought. I was doing just like the colonel said. I wasn't worrying, and I was drinking my liquor, but I didn't think it was bothering nobody. But one night, a cop put an order off the wire that said for me to be in the chief dispatcher's office next morning. And of course, I was there. The old chief was a kind old gentleman. He tried to talk to me like a father. Tried to explain to me that as a telegraph operator handling train orders, I was really handling people's lives. And that it was foolish to try to do this kind of a job drunk. He tried to be nice, but I just couldn't take it that way. I figured I had spilt more trying to take a drink than he'd ever drank. So in no uncertain terms, I told him exactly what he could do with his railroad, and I quit. And I didn't lose a day from work. Next morning, I went to work for the N&W. Men were scarce, even my kind. But I wasn't with the N&W very long. After just a few weeks, they called me in, and, well, the old chief over there, he didn't even try to be nice. He just said, "You get the hell off this railroad, don't you come back even with a ticket." Well, I hadn't been drunk all the time. We was expecting a family, and I had to work somewhere. So I swallowed my pride, and I had a whole lot of it then. I went back to Richmond, Virginia, to the old chief over to Southern, and very humbly asked for my job back, and I got it. After promising, of course, that I never was going to take another drink. Some 2 months later, one night, but for the grace of God, I would have killed 2 trainloads of people. I was fired in no uncertain terms and advised by mail a few days later that it would be a waste of time for me to try to get any kind of a job with any railroad within the continental limits of the United States, that my name was going to be passed around, and it was. I tried the Union Pacific out in Texas, the Great Northern up in Maine, the Florida and East Coast down in Miami. All these folks knew me better than my wife did. Things began to get a little rough then. I drifted from one laborer's job to another till finally I couldn't get even that. My wife had to go to work, and she did real well for a small town, but the best she could do didn't much more than keep me in liquor. Of course, our credit ran out. In fact, the merchants at home hated to sell my wife groceries for cash because they afraid I was going to eat some of them. And for some reason, I read in the paper one day that as a disabled veteran, I was eligible for educational benefits. That I could not only go to the school of my choice and take up whatever I choose to do, but that the government would pay me $135 a month while I was going to school. So I went back to Lynchburg, Virginia, where I had already been fairly well educated in some of the better institutions. And I enrolled in a course in high accounting at a small business college. Not because of any sudden thirst for knowledge, but simply to draw $135 a month, because that was at least $125 more than I could earn, honestly. And after registering at the school, I had a few days before classes started. Sitting around the rooming house one day, I got to thinking back, and I recall different ones in the past having talked about going to a priest and signing a pledge. And I couldn't remember ever having heard one of them say that he broke his pledge. So I decided I'd try that. I wasn't a Catholic. Hell, I wasn't a Protestant neither. I wasn't nothing. But I went to Father Howe, and he was well up on such things. He knew exactly what I was talking about. He brought out this very legal-looking document, and he wrote on it for a while. And then he signed it, and I signed it. A solemn oath in the presence of God that for 365 days I wouldn't take anything containing alcohol. And believe it or not, I kept that pledge. The longest, most god-awful year of my misspent life up until that time. During this year, I took a few Benzedrine, got up to about 25 a day, smoked a few aspirin, that's poor man's marijuana, smoked a little nutmeg, that's got opium in it. But didn't do too much of this, because I'd learned years ago that nutmeg is a dead giveaway. Because you meet a drunk on the street and he ain't bathed or shaved for about 2 months, he ain't supposed to smell like no fruitcake. So for 12 months I used a few of these little things, but I didn't drink. And when that year was over, I had good grades, an all-round average of 98.6. And believe me, I'm anything but smart. But when you're taking them many benzes a day, you got to do something with your time. You ain't gonna sleep much. So I've been studying. And also, when that year was up, I had finished all of my major subjects. I had a few more words to get in typing, a few more in shorthand. I had to take filing, little snap subjects. I figured that I had 3 more months in school, and for this short period, I could handle a little light stuff like beer. I think maybe I figured, too, I sort of owed it to myself for this great sacrifice I'd made. So I started off on beer, and then I switched to wine. Then I began mixing a little rub or a little Solox with it. Ain't it amazing what them two ingredients can do for one another? The rub takes something, puts something in the wine that it needs, and the wine takes something away from the rub it ought not to have in the first place. Well, you know what happened. One day in typing class, me and a typewriter just roll out in the floor. And to cover up this sudden fainting spell, I invented heart trouble. I told Miss Price, the lovely old lady who was a typing instructor, that ever since I'd come out of service, in fact, the real reason I was discharged was because of a mild case of angina. It wasn't nothing to get excited about, that I'd be perfectly all right if I could just go back to my room and kind of rest up for a couple of days. And bless her heart, she bought that. But the dean of men was an old Navy man. He knew a drunk when he saw one. So he took me in his office and he told me, by all means, go back to my room, but not just for a couple of days, to take all that week. This was on a Monday, and he says, if you're not sober and perfectly all right by Friday, you better just get on out of town. Because much as we would hate to expel you with your scholastic record, we're not operating a school for your kind of people. So I went back to my room, and I wasn't worried. I'd gotten over 1,000 drunks by myself. I still think maybe what threw me was having a deadline to me. Be sober by Friday. Anyway, when Friday rolled around, I was even drunker than I was on Monday. And late that night, I found myself sitting on a dark, lonely street corner up next to the Arlington Hotel. This was the night that I reached a point beyond which something inside of me could not or would not go. Or as we say in AA, I hit bottom. For on the street corner that night, for the first time, I took an honest look at Talbot Haggard, and I despised everything I saw. I had a good look at the past and saw nothing but filth and rottenness. A good look at the present and saw more filth and more rottenness. As for the future, I wanted no part of anything tomorrow might have to offer, because it couldn't be good if I was to be any part of it. And for the first time in my life, I seriously thought of suicide. I knew when this thought occurred to me that I couldn't do it in true alcoholic fashion, jumping from the highest building in town with the band playing and the spotlight on me. I won't up to that. I knew, too, that I couldn't shoot myself or jump off of a bridge because I wasn't that much of a man. But I'd heard of different ones having taken an overdose of sleeping pills. I knew I could do that. And I had a pocket full of these sleeping pills. I was 32 years old. And all I had to show for my 32 years on this earth were the clothes I had on my back, four pieces, counting the shoes separate. I had a bottle of wine, a bag of tobacco, a bottle of aspirin, and this pocket full of sleeping pills. Not much to show. And I'd like to think that this thought of suicide came to me because there was some spark of decency somewhere inside of me. But I'm afraid to say that, because I don't think there was, or ever had been, a spark of decency anywhere in my being. I'd like to think that this thought came to me because of some respect I felt for a lady who lived 60 miles away. A lady who had a piece of paper that said legally she and I were man and wife. And this is the nearest thing to a marriage that that lady ever had. But I'm afraid to say that because I don't think I had any respect for this lady. I don't think I had ever felt respect for any human being. Not even myself. I'd like to think that this thought of suicide came because of some love that I felt for a little boy, 5 years old. A little boy who lived in the house with that lady. A little fellow who had never had a father. But for his 5 years had been caged up in a house from time to time with a wild animal. An animal of which he was deathly afraid. But I'm afraid to say even that, because I don't think I did love this little boy. I don't think I had any conception of just what love was, much less the capacity for feeling it for another human being. No, I think this thought of suicide came simply because, not maybe because I wanted to die, but because I could no longer stand to live. I had everything on earth to live for, but not one thing I could live with. And I know I was going to take these pills. But while I was getting primed up for it, I heard men's voices from somewhere in the distance, and they were laughing. And when I heard them laugh, I hated them. Hated them because I hadn't been able to laugh for a long, long time. And I kind of drew up in a knot waiting for them to go by, and I knew they'd go by because nobody stopped for me except the police. But a very strange and a very wonderful thing happened. They did stop. And they sat down on that dirty street corner and talked to a filthy drunk. Three of these men were total strangers. I'd never seen them. I knew them by reputation. One was a member of the city council. Another, a very successful businessman. One, a multimillionaire. I had nothing in common with these people and wanted no part of them. But the fourth one was a man that I'd spent a lot of time on the riverbank and down on the railroad track and under the bridge with. Man I'd spent a lot of time in jail with. Shared a many a bottle of rub and a can of smoke and a can of Solox. A boy named Ham Masters. Remember that name. I may mention it once more. When I recognized Ham, I offered him a smoke and a drink. He just smiled and he says, Talbot, I haven't had a drink for 3 years. I couldn't believe that. Because I knew Ham was just as much of a drunk and the same kind of a drunk that I was. But anyway, these men spent some 2 hours that night on that street corner talking to me about something called AA. And it sounded wonderful. When the meeting broke up, Ham went with me and found me a room. He even spent the night with me. And I never have understood that quite, because I smell like something that you don't usually find out on the street. But he did stay with me and didn't even take my bottle away from me. Next morning, one of these men came and got me and took me to City Hospital, put me in a private room, clean sheets, and for a few days I was treated like somebody. And I wasn't used to this. A few days later, this same man came and got me, paid my hospital bill, got my prescriptions filled, and he paid for these because I didn't have a dime. And he took me to his home. All of the following week, there was somebody with me around the clock for my aid. They didn't even let me go to the bathroom by myself because they didn't trust me. And I didn't trust me either. The following Thursday night, they took me to my first AA meeting. And if it was ever Doubting Thomas that came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was Talbot Haight. These men had told me the many wonderful things that AA had done for them, and I believed it because it showed. But could it do it for me? I didn't think so. Because everything in the book had been tried on me. I'd been preached at and prayed over. I'd been overly mothered and underly fathered. I'd been lied to and lied about, and I'd been paid, I'd been cheated, I'd been locked in and locked out and locked up. The doctors had told me that if I didn't quit drinking, I was going to die with cirrhosis of the liver. The psychiatrist had told me that if I quit, if it didn't kill me, I'd end up even more mentally unbalanced than I was. The preachers had told me that if I died drunk, I was going to hell. One of them even told me that's where I ought to be. I even had one run in with two representatives of our local chapter of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. There's an outfit for you. These two lovely old ladies fell in on me one evening about sundown, and I was defenseless, down. I was batching, my wife, she'd been gone, and they lit in on me with all 4 feet. They told me I was a disgrace to my family, a disgrace to the town of Clover, and you ought to know that town. They said I was a disgrace to the whole human race, that all I'd ever done was make one mistake after another ever since the day I was born. They even insinuated my being born was the biggest mistake been made. But now all of these were good, well-meaning people. They did the best they could with what they had. But nothing had ever worked for me. I was sort of like the tomcat that got locked up in the taxidermy shop. I tried everything, but just did nothing work. And I didn't think AA would either. And it was in this frame of mind that I went to my first AA meeting. I don't know what I expected to find. I wasn't prepared for what I did find. I walked in on a club room about the size of this, a group of about 30, 35 people. But these were different kinds of people than I was used to associating with. The men were shaved, and they had on clean shirts. A few of them had on ties. One smart aleck even had on a coat. I didn't even own a coat. And the ladies had the hair comb. They had on lipstick. It didn't look like it got hit in the mouth with it. It was on straight. And they were smiling because these were happy people. In fact, they looked so happy I felt out of place. And before I could duck out, and I was going to duck out, this real pretty little lady from way over in the middle of the group got up and came over to me, and she said, "My name is Ruth Dickens, and I'm glad you made it tonight." And she shook hands with me. Not one of these flabby, wishy-washy things that don't mean nothing, but the kind of handshake that says, "I know all about you, but I love you." And Ruth meant that. Within the first 10 minutes, I shook hands with everybody in there. And they were all just like Ruth. They all meant it. I don't remember too much about the meeting that night. I know they opened it in the same manner we opened this one, with a short prayer that I thought was the most beautiful thing I had ever heard. They had a speaker, and I don't remember what he said. I know for the first time in my life, I heard alcoholism and alcoholics and drunks discussed in a way that made sense. And while that meeting was going on, something came over me, a feeling that I had never had. You see, I had always been a misfit. I had never felt welcome or a part of any segment of society, high or low. But that night I had the feeling that I've found my people. I've come home. And this was a wonderful feeling. When the speaker sat down, the chairman got up and he says, "We have no dues or fees." And I thought, I knew damn well there was a catch to it. But he says, "When the hat passes you, if you've got some, drop it in. If you ain't, take some out." And I thought, hell, you can't beat a deal like that. I got a quarter, and I didn't buy a drink with it. I got a pack of cigarettes. And I think maybe it was just coincidence that that hat didn't pass me no more for a long time. Time is running short, and I know you're all tired. I was to know 11 years. The kind of happiness that I had never dreamed possible for me. But then, late in 1962, I found myself in a little financial difficulty. I had a fairly profitable little public accounting business up in Virginia. And I had been very active in AA all over the country. One of the very fortunate ones. But without any thought of any of these 12 steps, certainly with no thought of the 11th step, without any benefit of prayer or meditation, without any thought of what God's will might be in this matter, I decided one night to drop out of AA, work real hard for a little while, and get this little business built back up on its feet, then take in a partner and come back to AA. And I did this. In November 1962, I stopped going to meetings. I didn't have time to make a 12-step call, and there were a lot of them. I didn't even have time to drink a cup of coffee with an AA friend. I worked 18, 20 hours a day. And on April 15th, 1963, Around midnight, when I dropped the last batch of tax returns in the mailbox, I went to a bootlegging joint to have just one drink. Then I was going home. I got home some 8 days later. 16 months later, on July 1st, 1964, I was committed by court order to Eastern State Hospital, a state-operated mental institution in Williamsburg, Virginia. I came to some 3 days after I got there, and I was still in what they call the receiving section. Ordinarily, a patient is not kept there but 24 hours. It was 5 days before they untied me. I was tied to a bed. Some 2-3 weeks later, one afternoon when I was out walking on the grounds with the keepers and the other patients, I looked around at these patients. They were all mental patients. They were there because they couldn't help it. But why was I there? I was there because I wasn't grateful for what this wonderful God of my understanding, thousands of friends like you, had given me. Now, feeling of gratefulness is not enough. God expects from me and from you an attitude of gratitude. Not just say you're grateful. Show you are. I was there because of a lack of faith in this God who had actually given me life, something I'd never had. I was there because of a lack of faith in you, the only friends I've ever known, a lack of faith in all that you stood for. I was there because of too much faith in the only weak link in this chain, Talbot Hagen. From somewhere in the past came the words, "Isn't it strange that princes and kings and clowns that caper in sawdust rings and common folk like you and me are builders for eternity? Have we been builders who built with care? Have we measured life by the rule and the square? Or have we been wreckers that stalk the town, content with the labors of tearing down?" I wasn't a builder. I was a wrecker. Because I had wrecked not only a very wonderful life, but the hopes and dreams and heartfelt prayers of a lot of other people. People who didn't deserve to be hurt. But unlike the night on the street corner when there was no thought of God, that afternoon at Eastern State Hospital, my first thought was of God. And I said, "Dear God, if I'm worth fooling with, may I have one more chance? May I go back to AA if they'll take me back? There, with your help and theirs, perhaps I can still rebuild of the lumber that's left in my life. Not another tavern, but a temple. Dedicated not to my own selfish desires or selfish pursuits, but dedicated to the service of God, to the service and the love of man." That afternoon, a very strange feeling, a feeling that I had just prayed this prayer and nobody heard it. 33 days from the time I was committed to Eastern State, I wasn't released, I escaped. The first night out, I went to an AA meeting, fully intending to take up where I left off. That night when the meeting was over, I got with a couple of winos and I got drunk. I was not to get off so lightly. It took 5 hellishly long years to find where I left off. I didn't leave off in carrying the message. I didn't leave off in making amends. What had I really done? I had left off really with the first step. That night I walked into a bootleg in Johns, telling myself I was just going to have one drink. I was really telling me that I'm not an alcoholic. That I don't need God, I don't need you. I can manage my life. On July 24th, 1968, I took what I hope was for me my last drink. And for this, I am as grateful as I'm capable of being. Not near grateful enough. Because there are times, even now, when I take all of this for granted, and I haven't that right. For sobriety, in the beginning for me, and this second time too, was an outright gift from a kind and a loving God. I hadn't earned this. There are some who may think that they had earned it in the beginning, but this would make this precious gift a sort of a reward for some great thing we had done in the past. And we don't have that kind of a past. It is a gift. And it's free for a certain length of time, and then we have to begin earning it. And we're taught to live one day at a time. So we have to earn this gift one day at a time. But every day, my sponsor says, easy does it, but damn it, do it. And I have to believe this. Some 10 years ago at a Blackstone retreat, I overheard Tommy Lovin say something that was to make a great difference years later in what I would say in front of a group such as this. For Tommy said, there are too many sad stories told in AA. Too much emphasis is placed on the hell and the misery and the heartache that all alcoholics have known. But not near enough is said about his accomplishments and the good things that come to him. I left Blackstone that weekend asking myself, how could I tell anybody of my accomplishments and of the many wonderful things that have come to me through my affiliation with you wonderful people and a close association with the God of my understanding? And it's just recently that I've realized that it will be very simple for me to tell this, because I haven't accomplished anything. For usually when one speaks of accomplishments, they're thinking in terms of money in the bank, or stocks and bonds, or property, financial position, or maybe social standing. And I've never had any of these things. But fortunately, I've never felt the need of them. But some truly wonderful things have happened. But not because of anything I've done. These things came to me because the God of my understanding is a kind and a loving God. A God who, in spite of all my wrongs, has always dealt very gently with me. These things came too because I am blessed with literally thousands of wonderfully close friends. And for some reason, they love me too. You see, when I came into AA the first time, and also this last time, I had bottled up inside of me a lot of the wrong kind of things. For all of my life, I had felt that I was different from other people because I looked different. And because of this difference, I resented other people. And I resented myself. And I resented God. Because I couldn't do anything about this difference except hide it from myself in a bottle for a long time, I felt sorry for myself. And believe me, I have never been as sorry as when I was feeling sorry for me. Because I felt that this difference was not of my own doing. Because I felt that I'd been dealt a hand that somehow I just couldn't play. Because I was doomed to a life of endless drunken wandering. I hated other people. I hated myself. And I hated God. But some truly wonderful things have happened. For now, in place of the resentment, there's a warm feeling of peace. A sort of a quietness within. And I've never felt this before. I'm not at war anymore. I'm at peace with my fellow man. And I'm at peace with myself. And I'm at peace with my God. And in place of the self-pity, there's a feeling of gladness. For I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful even for the years of loneliness, of being without a home and family and friends. Grateful for the time spent in jails and hospitals and insane asylums. Grateful even that I had to go back and spend 5 more years in this place called hell. Because rough though this may have been, it was a small price really to pay for what I have now. For what I have found here with you. And best of all, in place of the hate, there's a heart full of love. Both for this wonderful God of my understanding and for every one of you. This is what makes AA work. This simple little thing called love. And here in AA, we have different kinds of love. First, there's our love for each other. For among the membership of this fellowship, you find people from literally every walk of life. Ministers, preachers, doctors, lawyers, nurses, housewives, painters, successful career women, successful businessmen, and a lot of bums like me. But here, we meet on common ground. Financial standing or social position is neither a hindrance nor a help. For here in this wonderful fellowship, we are bound together by one common problem. And in our search together for a solution to that problem, there's born within each of us a feeling for one another. That feeling is love. Then there's another love, our love for God. And surely there's no group of people anywhere on the face of the earth this morning with a greater reason for loving God than you and I. Then there's still another love, greater than both of these. God's love for us. And I heard a story once that I think exemplifies this particular love. Story of an old tenant farmer and his family who lived in the northern part of Georgia. And I don't mean this disrespectfully, but we all know that from an agricultural standpoint, North Georgia is not the most. Any man that digs a living out of the ground fully deserves a few blessings that he gets. But as the story goes, this particular year when the crops were sold and the cotton seed and the fertilizer bills were paid, there was a little money left over. Not much, just $5. But it was the first time there'd ever been any leftover since this family had been a family. They felt that it called for some kind of a celebration. But knowing the value of a dollar, they knew that they couldn't each one go out and buy something. So they got out the Sidnor book catalog, and after much thumbing through the pages, they finally settled on one thing, something they could all enjoy equally. It was a looking glass, a mirror. They'd never seen one. But they made out their order, mailed it off, and after many days of anxious waiting, the postman blew the horn down at the foot of the hill, and they went down and got the package, and a little later, they gathered around the kitchen table and opened it. And of course, Pa, being the head of the household, was the first to see himself in the mirror. And when he looked, all he said was, "Well, I'll declare." Then he handed it to Ma, and she looked, and she just smiled. Then she gave it to little Sis, and she preened, and she giggled. Then it was little Joe's turn. Little Joe was one of the gentle people. A little fellow about 12 or 13. Back when he was just a wee small tot, he'd been kicked in the face by a mule. He wasn't a handsome child. And when he saw himself for the first time, he didn't know whether to laugh or cry. And he looked at his mom and he says, "Mom, did you know I looked like this?" She says, "Yes, son. I knowed it all the time." He said, "You knowed I was this ugly, and you still love me?" She says, "Yes, son. I loved you 'cause you're mine." This, I think, must be the kind of love that God has for you and me. For surely he has seen us in all of our ugliness. None of the wrong, rotten things that we did were hidden from him. He saw them all. And yet when the day came, we found ourselves flat of our backs, unable to even get up, much less stay up. We knew that day that we couldn't go any further without help. But we knew, too, there was no need to expect help from friends, because all the friends were gone. Now, was there any need to expect help from family? Because the family, too, was gone. This didn't leave anybody but God, and we hated to ask him. But we did ask because we had to. And what happened? Without once reminding us of any of the wrong, rotten things we'd done to hurt him, to hurt other people, and to hurt ourselves. Without one word of reproach, without a moment's hesitation, he simply reached out a hand that held all the help that you and I will ever need. That hand is still there. It always will be. The hand of AA. I'm grateful to my God for bringing me to AA. And I'm grateful to AA for bringing me back to my God. And I hope and pray with all my heart that I may never again turn my back and walk away from this to drink again, because I might not make it back another time. Some 3.5 years ago, a man who I owe perhaps more to than anyone on earth, with 18 years of a happy, contented sobriety, went to a cocktail party one night given by his boss. And sometimes during the course of the evening, he drank one highball. 3 weeks later, he went into the garage and he shot himself. His name? Ham Masters. As I say, I hope I never again leave AA to drink again, because I might not make it back. But if for any reason one of us should have to leave, I'd much rather it be me than you. Because for all that you have done and are still doing for me, I love you. I'm sorry it's taken me so long to say so little, but thank you so much for listening. Thank you for letting me be a part of your lives and for giving me a place in your hearts. This is the only place I can live. And when you say your prayers tonight, please pray for me. I'll do the same thing for you. God bless you.